Welcome to the CB Wallet Podcast. I'm Phil Lucas.
And I'm Phil Jarrod. Why are we here, Phil?
We're here to talk about the world's greatest disasters. What went wrong, how it went wrong, and whether it was our fault or God's fault.
And remember, it's not our intention, Phil, to make light of the sometimes quite substantial mortality rates in some of these disasters.
No.
We are just interested in finding out what went wrong. And be honest, Phil. Be honest with yourself. You know, if you came on the news, you'd be interested, wouldn't you?
Yep. I want data, facts, pie graphs, 24/7 coverage.
Absolutely. What are we talking about this week?
The Battle of Isle Awana.
I thought we were doing Rorke's Drift.
Bah. Well, we sort of are.
Right.
Think we're at Rorke's Drift, yeah. Unless you're heavily Zulu or a massive Zulu sympathiser.
Yeah.
Not really a disaster.
Yeah, right.
Battle of Isle Awana links nicely in. You'll see why later.
Oh, okay.
Is a disaster.
So this is sort of Rorke's Drift in context.
In context,
so
yes.
What are we doing this week?
We're doing the Battle of Isle Awana.
Rorke's Drift in context.
January the 22nd, 1879. The Battle of Isandlwana. In today's South Africa, the British Army suffers its most humiliating defeat. Extraordinary military blunders allow Zulus, most armed with just spears, to crush a modern British army. Yet, bizarrely, this day is remembered as one of our finest.
So, Phil, the Battle of Isle Awana. Am I saying that right?
I don't know. I mean, we've both got it written down in phonetically in front of us.
Yeah, but you went online and you listened to some Americans saying it.
I listened to three people saying it, two American, one British. They all said it differently.
God bless the English and the Americans. They're almost the worst people on earth to ask, aren't
Have
they?
You been a Scotchland?
Yeah, so I think it's Isle Awana, right?
I guess. We stand to be corrected.
I mean, I wonder if one of the reasons, of the many reasons why Rorke's Drift is famous and Isle Awana is not, is because Rorke's Drift sounds like a pub. You can see Victorian gentlemen kindly going, fucking Battle of Rorke's Drift, mate. I can't say, tell you what, have you heard about that Isle Awana? Doesn't roll off the tongue for a British person quite as much.
It certainly doesn't.
This is South Africa, right?
Yes, what would now be called South Africa, but in those days was Southern Africa.
Okay, so what was it, the Battle of Isle Awana?
It was the first major encounter in the Anglo-Zulu War between the British Empire, God bless her, and the Zulu Kingdom.
When did it happen?
22nd of January, 1879.
And how many people died?
Roughly 3,300. That would be 1,300 on the British Empire side and about 2,000 on the Zulu side.
So that's roughly the same. Right? Why is it a disaster? If the same, it's battles, isn't it? Isn't it all the same? Don't they just generally wars? People fight, battles, dying. That's how I understand it. I've seen Platoon.
Well, in this country, Isle Awana has historically been viewed as a disaster,
right?
Because despite the huge weapons advantage that the British had, the Zulus, which were numerically superior, 12,000 against 1,300, essentially. That's quite a big amount. The Zulus, they absolutely wiped out the British force. It was a rout.
They did it by superior numbers.
Superior numbers, superior tactics, and spears.
This is going to be a little bit bound up with a little bit of good old-fashioned British racism, isn't it,
I think. It's going that way.
Because I guess there was a bit of a, especially in the Victorian area, a bit of a sort of, you know, we're going out there with guns and helmets and they've got sort of sharpened fruit and bare feet.
Expansionism and ownership. Gatling guns v. guavas.
Yeah, I mean, reading through...
Do you get guavas in Africa?
I have no idea, but I like the... I think we probably do. Surely, because you don't get them in Peckham, do you?
It's a continental fruit.
Is it a continental fruit?
Yeah.
Either way, I wouldn't fight with it. looking through the research that... you've done for this podcast. Listeners to the podcast might be interested to know that all the research for this podcast is done by Mr. Phil Lucas.
Thank you.
Take a bow, Mr. Phil Lucas.
Thank you. And not, as some people have said to us, oh, you just take it off Wikipedia. I don't.
No, you don't, do you?
Numerous sources.
Yeah.
And then merge, rewrite.
I mean, you fact check it with Wikipedia. But going through the research that you've done for this, we don't come out well. But then when did we ever? in Victorian. I mean, we don't look great, do we? Unless we're building bridges, we look like proper dicks.
Well, I went through it and was like, But then I remembered, you know, My Country Right or Wrong.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's right. He hasn't got a Charles and Di plate on his mantelpiece for nothing, have you? Are you patriotic?
Yes.
Really? There is no... It's mental that we're friends. I have no patriotic bone in my body.
That's because you exist within your sphere of being born and dying. You have no concept of living as an organism within a greater structure than you and purpose.
What, is it calling me you're calling me a sort of biological narcissist? I mean, okay, take the criticism on board. But what do you, are you genuinely though, like what do you feel about it? Because it's because I'm not being like, like lots of comics have like this line, don't they? Like, oh, this is where I, you know, my parents fucked here and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like British or English, or I don't even feel like a citizen of the world particularly. No.
I'm proud of being British.
Are you?
Yeah.
What are you proud
of? Not proud of being British in the sense that that makes me better.
No.
A French person who is proud of being French is equal.
What are you proud of, though?
I'm proud of the fact we live in a country that has a certain history, a certain culture, a certain way of behaving, a certain way we've developed.
But you hate it here.
What?
You hate it here.
I hate anywhere.
No, you wouldn't you? Like, there must be another country you'd turn up, you'd be having a lovely time.
No, you're right. The trouble is, I love Britain so much that I almost want to emigrate because it's so bad now. So rather than fight to make it better,
I just go to Spain.
Sod this. Yeah. Just find myself a hill in Croatia.
I do find that the most patriotic people seem to be people who don't live here.
Yeah. Well, it's roasting to glasses.
Yeah, you know? Terribly patriotic on the beaches of Spain, aren't they? I'd like to be patriotic, I think. I'd like to feel an emotion. Just any emotion.
Well, I sort of feel that I'm a chain.
Are you?
You're a part of what's gone before.
Yeah.
You're a link to what's going to happen in the future. I respect the royal family.
Really?
Yes.
I can't understand that. I would abolish the royal family. You know,
we have to have something.
Do we?
Yeah, we're a grubby little virus of a species, and we need something to
need
keep
Prince
us
Charles?
In control. No, you laugh, right? You laugh. The monarchy actually has a fundamental constitutional role.
Would you like genuflect?
Would I what?
Would you genuflect?
What does that
mean? Would you like kneel and bow and scrape and toke forelog tug if you met them and all the rest
well,
of that?
Well, I would follow etiquette if that's what you mean.
I don't think I would follow etiquette.
But I'm not scum.
I am scum though, and I'm quite proud of it. Yeah. And I would find it really difficult.
That's why you're happy to live in filthy, dirty Brighton where people can live on the beach for as long as they want, creating a disgraceful atmosphere of street drinking. You just go, yeah, well, people just have to be how they are. It's like, no.
Yeah, live and let live in it.
No,
live
and let live. We all end up in slums. Like I've always said, slums don't make themselves.
Slums, nice slums, though. Nice, well-stocked slums with everybody happy. Everybody dirty, everybody happy. My mum met the Queen.
Oh, yeah.
And didn't follow etiquette.
Or did she not? Oh, what happened?
She was just a bit shunned, I think. But the thing is, the etiquette.
There
is,
you go.
The etiquette is so mad. It was like it's like eye contact and and speaking when spoken to and all this sort of thing.
Yeah, but there's a reason for that.
I think she asked the Queen a question or something.
You
like
don't.
That
is a no-no.
And that just makes my blood boil that you can't ask the woman a question.
Yeah, but you have to look back and remember that the Queen is better than you.
No, she's not.
No,
in
she
what way is.
Is
the Queen better than me? Can she do as many press-ups as me? All right, bad example.
Really bad example.
Can,
she probably could.
Has she seen as many episodes of Columbo as I've seen?
Probably.
All
don't
right.
know, do you?
Can she recite the second series of Blackadder? Well, neither of us can do that.
We
don't
know.
I brought that
we
up.
Don't know. She does like George Formby, though, the Queen.
Yeah, she probably is a better... Does she?
A George Formby fan.
Do you think the reason she doesn't have corgis anymore is because they were worried they'd outlive her?
She don't have them anymore.
No, they're all dead.
And she didn't replace them.
Didn't replace them.
Because
she's a lizard.
Standards is what it comes down to.
Yeah?
Just standards.
Standards of...
Things can't go around looking grubby with no order. We need people that are...
I know for a fact that you had a mushroom growing out your bath the other day.
That's not my fault. That was moisture. That was unexpected moisture build-up. And you know what standards were? Get it gone straight
away. Get
it gone,
absolutely. Yeah. Get it gone.
I wasn't proud of that.
I don't think the Queen would stand for that.
I wasn't proud of that. I would tell nobody that.
Oh, really? So
now you've broadcast that to at least about 7 listeners.
Oh, do I need to cut that out?
No.
Okay. Okay, so... let's put this Zulu War in context.
Mm.
The Anglo-Zulu War of 1879 saw over 15,000 British troops invade the independent nation of Zululand, which is present-day South Africa. We basically invaded this place.
Yes.
Like proper Adolf Hitler, we fancy it, invade it.
Yeah? In short, yeah.
Yeah, invaded it.
Yeah. We wanted control of the whole of that area, and one of the barriers to that was having a control of Zululand.
Yeah.
Who were a very dominant tribe in that area. A little bit warmongering in places. They weren't exactly...
But they can be warmongering in their own... They can have a bit of a warmonger in their own...
They had a lot of warmongering in their own little region. But the short of it is we wanted control of that area sort of replicate what we'd done at that time in Canada.
In Canada?
Well, we'd kind of got the different regions and the different regions of Canada and kind of pushed them all together under a sort of British control.
Worked in Canada then, because it's a nice place now.
And that was the logic.
Probably still not right, though. I feel like if I want to go home to my flat and do a bit of warmongering, I don't feel like somebody should come in and piss about with me.
Well, you might have a point. I'm not defending the British.
No, good point.
British Empire's invasion of Zululand.
No, that is when people ask me about you. That is one of the first things I tell them.
Yeah,
I tell them he is not pro the British invasion of Zululand in the latter Victorian period.
My country, right or wrong?
Okay. The build up to the war started in 1877 when Sir Henry Freire, he of the Ferrero-Rocher fame, I suppose.
Yes, he invented it.
He was the British colonial administrator. Do they still have one of those, you think? They've probably got a different name.
Yeah, colonial's not a word that gets bandied about much. Or empire.
Rees-Mogg would bring back the British colonial administrator, wouldn't he?
He would.
He definitely puts on a pith helmet and pretends to be that
He does. He's got an overgrown garden that he goes and explores in the safari. So I love Jacob Rees-Mogg. I think he's tremendous.
Okay, so this Ferrero-Rocher guy, he was sent to Cape Town with the task of uniting South Africa under a single British confederation.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you and you, fuck off.
Very much the Victorian way.
Yes, that's right. So it wasn't long before Ferrero-Rocher, he realised that uniting all of those republics, states and British colonies, it couldn't be done until they'd cleared away the whole Zulu kingdom to the north. He needed to defeat all of those people or it wouldn't work.
Cleared away is slightly pejorative. I think what they're trying to say is dominate and bring into the fold under British rulership. We're not talking about... clear them out in a genocide.
So it wasn't genocide. It wasn't like in America where they were like, we don't really want any indigenous people here anymore. They were just like, we would really, really rather prefer it if you just did everything we said, okay?
I think it's more that.
Okay, well that sounds...
I mean, how that was achieved is arguable, but it wasn't a planned genocide.
But there was this thing, wasn't there, with the Victorians, which is like, look, we found a better way of doing it. It's working bloody well. I think we ought to do it. We'll have a lovely time. If you don't do it, I might shoot you in the back, all right? Well, so it's a bit like that,
tremendous
right?
Tremendous Cecil Rhodes impression.
Thank you very much. I don't know who he is.
Don't know who he is?
No, who's Cecil Rhodes?
Cecil Rhodes was a pro-British expansion politician.
Oh, yeah.
He did a lot of good things, actually. He started Rhodes College in Oxford with scholarships for people. He is who the former country of Rhodesia is named after.
Oh,
yes.
Really?
But he did also believe that the white man was superior and lesser peoples needed to be subjugated.
Isn't he the statue that they tried to get rid of?
He's the statue they're trying to get rid of.
You're such a lizard.
Why am I a lizard? I'm just giving you the facts.
I know you're giving me the facts.
I'm giving you the facts.
You just said...
What have I done wrong there?
You've not done nothing wrong.
You asked me Cecil Rhodes.
I told you. You didn't open with he's a famous racist.
Why would I open with that?
Because that's what people would open with if he's a famous racist.
No, I am not going to open with your 21st century social leanings, putting them onto a bloke 150 years ago who can't defend himself. What I'm going to do is tell you about that guy.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to tell you about the areas where nowadays that might be considered the wrong thing to have done. I'm not defending Cecil Rhodes.
I know. Britain, at this point, didn't really want a war with the Zulus. I imagine...
They actually didn't know.
A lot of people didn't really know where South Africa was, who the Zulus were. I mean, especially at the end of the 19th century, it must have felt quite a long way away.
It must have been. I mean, I only found out last night.
Because my opinion of the end of the 19th century is all basically Jack the Ripper films. Just people wandering around London. Got to pick a pocket or two. Like, that's what I think about this point. I don't think that those people were interested so much in the Zulu War.
Well, the thing is, there comes a point, doesn't there, where you're so successfully expansionist.
Yeah.
You are conquering so much of Africa.
Yeah.
That these names coming back to you that most British people couldn't pronounce... a ten a penny.
Exactly.
You'd be, what's this? There's this place, yeah, okay, great. There's Jimba Booger, they're great, whatever. And yeah, they're just, they just merge.
I shared an office once with a woman from Ghana.
Mm.
I've told you this. I don't think I put it on the podcast. Mm. And when I first walked into the room, she said, hello, all the rest of it, small talk. And then she said, I just want to get this out of the way straight away. I don't want you to feel in any way sort of weird about, like, you know, your country's involvement in Ghana. I don't hold any grudges about that. That's not going to be a problem whatsoever.
Wow.
And I was like, I don't know what Britain did in Ghana.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
No, not a clue.
No one has ever told me anything about that at all. So from my point of view, it's going to be fine because I have not been informed that I've done anything wrong. Terrible, isn't it? Absolutely awful. She thought it was going to be a point of difficulty between the two of us.
What happened? Was it standard
even
British?
Even after that, I didn't find out.
No?
I imagine it's standard
Empire plundering and, yeah. Oh, right. Well, yeah. Why should you have an issue with it?
Well, no, it wasn't so much that I would or wouldn't. It was just the fact that, from her point of view, it's such a big thing that she think it would be like, I don't know, an Irish Protestant and an Irish Catholic from Northern Ireland sharing an office, going, all right, we're just going to not mention it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas it'd be like talk of a Catholic from Northern Ireland going, all right, I'm not going to do anything about that. I won't mention the Troubles. And then the Protestant going, the what?
Yeah.
The what now?
What?
Sorry, no, I didn't. We didn't have a telly. Was there a thing? Terrible. As we said, Britain didn't actually want a war with the Zulus. I don't think we really want a war with anyone, really.
No, we just wanted to own it all.
We wanted to own it.
And in the most peaceful means possible, if possible.
I wonder what the people wanted, though. Like, if you said to a person in the street, what's right, what's wrong, I bet would they have said, oh, yeah, I think what we're doing is good? If they'd known what it was. Because I don't think they knew what it was, right? Like, the man in the street.
Probably not, no.
Okay. So because they didn't want a war with the Zulu, Ferrero Rocher turned to the new British governor of the region, Phil?
Sir Theophilus Shepstone. Sir Theophilus Shepstone.
I think that's Theophilus.
Sir Theophilus Shepstone.
So basically, Sir Henry Ferrero Rocher went up to Theophilus P. Wildebeest and basically said, I want to invade this country. I want you to think of reasons that we can invade it.
Kind of.
Literally.
Essentially, yeah.
It's that black and white. Mm. We need to work out a way that we can get the people behind us. I don't know if this is ringing any bells with anybody in recent history. Anyway.
It's only 45 minutes till they could launch their spears at us.
Anyway, as Shepstone's territories were bordered by Zululand, again, this might ring some bells, he outlined a plan about how regular border incursions by the Zulus were affecting the stability of the region, which they probably weren't.
I think they're exaggerating.
He exaggerated the things that were actually happening. He also expressed concern over the increasing amount of firearms that were falling into Zulu hands. I assume that they were nicking them off the British.
A little bit of that, a tiny little bit of trading. These firearms were by and large obsolete.
But yeah, and they're going to be old, aren't they?
Yeah.
And also, this isn't 2018 guns and fire around corners. We're talking about Victorian guns.
Muskets.
Which were shit. And, like, really good Victorian guns were shit. So, like, how shit were crap Victorian guns? Really shit guns. But all of this was just bullshit to try and make a war, right? Then, in December 1878, an ultimatum was sent to the Zulu king, Phil.
King Cetshwayo.
Requiring him, amongst many other things, to disband his army, knowing that he would never do it, ever. Frere Roche then arranged for an army led by Lord Chelmsford to prepare for invasion, which also sounds very Iraq war, doesn't it? Sort of like ultimatums, you know, do something that they know he's not going to do, can't possibly do. Like, as if he'd go, oh, what? Yeah. So I'll just not be king anymore, and you'll just come in and take everything I've got. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. It wasn't unusual. This is how Victorians operated, right? This is how the British operated.
Yeah, this wasn't unusual. You know, during the Victorian period, you have to remember that the communication between colonial outposts and places where stations were trooped was really bad. It took weeks sometimes to get information through. So it wasn't uncommon for sort of consulates in that area to go off and start their own wars without government support back in the UK.
Isn't that mad? Isn't that mad that you could just be like Dave from Chepstow, and you're in Africa, and you can start your own war?
Yeah. And then once you're in,
they've got to back
you.
Oh, God, Dave started a war. Where is it? Ghana. Oh, God. That's going to make someone embarrassed in 2008 in his office. The Zulu War is notable for lots of bloody battles.
Mm.
The one we're talking about, the Battle of Isilowana, was followed almost immediately by Rorke's Drift, which is when the small band of plucky British troops repelled bloody loads, thousands of them.
4,000.
4,000 Zulus coming at them, right? And there is an argument, I guess, to be made to say that Rorke's Drift is not that important as a battle. But what it does do is deflect attention away from the Battle of Isilowana.
There is an argument to say that. I think that would be probably standard historical narrative at the moment. That
you reckon?
Yeah, I think that. I think
propaganda, basically. Mm. And we can all, you know, do you know what I mean? If we've made a film about it, it's bullshit. That's what I think. Dunkirk, bullshit.
That was bullshit.
Dunkirk's amazing, isn't it? It's like...
What, the real one or the film?
Well, the film was terrible.
Awful.
But like, I mean, really, just crap.
1980s seat covers on those trains.
Well, that was one of the worst parts of it.
Mm.
But it was boring, long crap, had no characters, had no drive. You didn't find out anything about it, you didn't care about it. It was really a poo thing.
Little ships with Phillips screw heads, only invented 4 years before. There's no small boat would have had complete Phillips screw heads in all that time, only invented 4 years previously. Nonsense.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It makes my blood boil. Did you genuinely think it was poo, like, as a film?
Yeah, I did. It was a very average film.
Whereas Zulu...
That's a great film.
It's a very good film.
It's an extremely good film. It's got a kind of Lawrence Arabia-esque sort of Panavision about it.
And it's not as racist. I mean, it has... Is it racist? It's not really racist.
It's not Bernard Breslau or Black Tuck.
No, it isn't.
Carrying Up the Jungle.
Yeah. And they did... You can see films, they might have had extras blacked up. Like that. It's not uncommon for films to do that. So they used actual people from...
One of the people in the Zulu film actually ended up being a high-ranking politician in South Africa.
Really?
One of the tribal leaders in the film.
Really?
Yeah, I can't remember his name. Wouldn't be able to pronounce it if I could.
No.
But he did end up...
Probably better than you don't. So Rorke's Drift is basically an eye-grabbing headline, plucky British underdogs. It's insane, isn't it, that we can still, like, think of ourselves as the underdogs in this sort of situation?
Well, we are in most things now.
Anyway, so obviously it's much more complex than all of this because wars are in it.
Yeah.
And it goes on into the Boer War, which is extremely complicated and kind of horrific. So we only got 40 minutes to do this quite difficult bit of thing.
Yes.
So if you want to find out about the Battle of Isilowana, I don't want to do our podcast down. This is probably just a jumping off point.
Yeah. Start your thorough studies of this topic with this podcast. This will give you a basic overview.
Yeah.
And then go on yourself, put yourself into the British Library, Imperial War Museum, some of the British Army archives.
Get on that microfiche.
Enjoy, yes, exactly that. Enjoy yourself. Really expand your knowledge on it. And if we can just make one person, Phil, really, really involve themselves in a thorough understanding of the Battle of Isilowana, then this podcast will really have
been a waste of time.
Right, have we cleared this? Have we made this clear? So essentially what we're talking about here is we're talking about a battle that is part of a wider Anglo-Zulu war. What we're also saying is there is another battle called Rorke's Drift, which you're probably more aware of because it's had a lot more media attention. There was a film made out of it. We're sort of saying that Rorke's Drift, which, you know, very, very noble thing, you know, 150 British soldiers held out against 4,000 Zulus. But what we're saying is in the context of the Battle of Isandlwana, which was earlier in the day, that was a complete rout. What I've done there is not made it any clearer.
Perfect. Tell me about the battle.
Now, the Battle of Isandlwana, okay, was not the first battle in the Anglo-Zulu War. The British had actually started their invasion 13 days previously. They'd had a couple of skirmishes, but it was the first major battle.
Right.
Okay. And they came a bit of a cropper, Phil.
I mean, I imagine they were expecting to just overrun it in a couple of days, right?
It's a lot more militarily tactical and complex than that, but essentially I think they just thought they were savages with spears,
yeah,
and their guns could just blow them away.
Yeah.
Sort of big mustachioed.
And they would have been, as all of them, by our standards, racists.
By our standards, yes.
Wouldn't they?
Yes.
They would have been like Johnny Foreigner. Probably not even Johnny. No, it wouldn't have been that. It would have been
savages.
Proper savages.
Mm.
Like, they're animals.
Mm.
Terrible.
This British invasion force that was going into Zululand, what they'd actually done is they'd split into three advancing columns. So the whole force had split into three sections.
Right.
A left, right, centre section. Fairly standard. All of this was led by a chap called Lord Chelmsford. Now,
okay,
he's a very important chap to remember because he will be using him a lot.
Okay.
Now, on the evening of the 20th of January, the centre section of this advancing column. That's the right one we're mainly thinking about, the centre section.
So I'm imagining like a column of blokes in red tunics and pith helmets.
Yep.
With guns just walking slowly
guns,
across
cavalry,
Africa.
Yeah.
Just walking slowly.
Yeah.
Across Africa.
Across Africa.
Okay, wicked.
Splitting off. So think of the beginning of Dad's Army.
Yeah.
And you know where the old
big red arrow
Nazi flag comes in.
Yeah.
And then it splits, doesn't it? And starts attacking different points of the French coast, sort of nodding towards Britain, going, we're going to get you, we're going to get you. And little Britain's going, now, that's it's the splitting that's important.
Okay.
There. Right.
Wicked.
Yeah. Okay. So on the evening of the 20th of January, the centre column camped at Isandlwana.
Okay.
All well and good for 2 days. Now, during those 2 days, one thing they did not do is start to entrench themselves.
What does that mean? Dig holes?
Dig holes, make defensive positions, make themselves in the best position if there was an attack.
Arrogant.
Absolutely.
Fucking British arrogance.
Mm. And the reason they didn't do that, now, the official reason they said is we wouldn't have had time. It would have taken over a week to do. The reality, however, it does seem to be that the British command severely underestimated the Zulu numbers and their capabilities.
Yeah, boy. That's exactly what it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
They put up tents, they had tiffin, they smoked a bowl.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
They said, we've got the big guns.
And I bet they looked at the sunset and they went, Africa, bloody, lovely, bloody Africa. And they didn't expect that they were going to be attacked.
I think that's it. You see, Chelmsford, old Lord Chelmsford, he believed that his force of over 4,000... And it's actually one thing that's quite interesting, is you always think it's British. Not always totally British. The 4,000 would include... Half of that would be British infantrymen, rifles, artillery, that sort of thing. Then you would have sort of auxiliary people that would, you know, that would help out. And then you sometimes have locals who were either paid, or in some cases you actually had Zulu refugees who were on the side of the British. So it wasn't always...
So, but I think... But
for the sake of argument, we'll say British.
Okay.
It makes life easier.
But if I was in a war and I was one of them, I'm legging it.
We already discovered you're a traitor.
Well, I would leg it.
Or a potential traitor.
I've got no horse in this race, right? I'll carry a wagon, you know, and I'll be like, yeah, it's British, whatever. But as soon as they start fighting, I'll be like, what, who? No, mate. No, they're my shoes. What are you talking about? Also, 4,000, the number feels like big, but it's not. That's the capacity of the Hammersmith Apollo. It's like, it's not a huge amount of people. It's not a huge amount of people, is it, 4,000?
It's not a huge amount, but I suppose it depends how many you're fighting the other side.
It does.
It's a huge amount if you're only going to come across 100 people of the other, of the enemy.
But what I mean is, you could, if you got that many people in the O2, then I think they'd cancel that gig, because that's not enough. That's not enough people to have a war in the O2.
That's true. So what you're saying is that if that is essentially a third of the force, because we've agreed they split up into three.
Oh, sorry, they split into three, didn't they?
Then 12,000 still isn't a massive amount to take a country.
No, it really isn't.
I mean, savages or no savages.
It's good for an Ed Sheeran concert.
It's worrying for an Ed Sheeran concert.
So.
Anyway, old Chelmsford, he essentially just thought that Zulus with their spears and cowhide shields and a few knocking about old obsolete guns and things just didn't have the firepower to overwhelm the British in any way. In fact, actually, he wrote before the battle, "If I am called upon to conduct operations against them, I shall strive to be in a position to show them how hopelessly inferior they are to us in fighting power, although numerically stronger."
I mean, A, brilliant impression.
Thank you.
And B, I love the fact that his own downfall is within that statement, although numerically stronger. You know what I mean? Mate, you're fucked. You are fucked, mate. And I tell you what, it's, because they're spears, it's hand-to-hand combat.
Yes, and this is the
and
thing.
And they are going to be shitloads better at you than that.
They were shitloads better. They were trained. Zulus is actually quite a, is often called a warrior race. They were trained in using weapons from the age of five. It's all about devotion to the king. Mm. So they were schooled in it. They were phenomenally well trained, great tacticians, really, really good warriors. Funny enough, in something completely different, in another battle, which the British won later in the war, the British were so impressed with the way the Zulus fought that when they put their monument up to their war dead, they put one up for Zulus as well.
Fucking hell. So, we're dickheads, aren't we? Such dickheads. Oh, God, I hate the British.
Fearless warriors. That's what they were.
That's what we do,
the Zulus,
isn't it?
I'm saying. Fucking, the fearless warriors, they said.
We what? Fucking go in places, we act like dicks, and then, you know, like when your bully tries to make friends with you at school, going, oh, you know, you took it like a man. Oh, fuck yourself.
So, once old blinkered Lord Chelmsford had established his camp, he set out two battalions to scout ahead. Now, they skirmished with some elements of Zulu force, which Chelmsford unfortunately believed to be the main vanguard of the British Army. So he's like, oh, OK, so we've discovered them. We've discovered them. So he then divided his force further, taking about 2,500 men out to find this main Zulu force that they've skirmished with.
Right.
Now, the problem here is it never occurred to Chelmsford that the Zulus he came across were a deliberately diverting tactic.
Arrogance again.
Arrogance again. They were deliberately put there to make the British think that was the main force.
Yeah.
They all went over there and the main force was somewhere completely different, just waiting.
They must have thought we were thick as pig shit.
Yeah. Mm. It was a very simple tactic.
Yeah.
So on the morning of the 22nd, therefore, this is the day of the war, the camp was left in the command of a colonel, a Poilin, who had about 1,300 men to defend his camp and not a great deal else. Now, throughout that morning, he did start to receive reports of large Zulu forces amassing.
At that point. Terrifying. What, where was everybody? 1,300 men is no men. That's nothing.
That's nothing, is it?
And I like forces amassing. Really? Forces amassing?
Well, this is the bit I like. About 11 a.m, a couple of poor old scouts just by pure chance stumbled upon the main Zulu army of 20,000 men sitting quietly in a nearby valley just waiting.
Fucking hell,
I would love to have seen their faces. Oh,
yeah. You'd know, wouldn't you?
Shit, yeah.
I think you'd know that you were about to be, that was it.
Yeah, you'll just go, this is going to be a rout.
Because the numbers are so mad.
Mm. So they're outnumbered virtually 20 to 1.
Fucking hell! That's a lot to 1.
Mm.
Yeah, if you said, I'm going to have to kill 20 Zulus just to stay alive, I don't fancy your chances.
No.
Even with a crappy Victorian gun, I don't think you're going to kill that many Zulus. They were fucked.
Yeah. Now, there are lots of things we could say here, Phil. To be honest, we don't have the time here to talk at length about any of the sort of various tactics that were used throughout the battle. You know, when you read anything about battles, it's where people went, tactics, who said what, who didn't say what. We haven't got time. Here's the short of it.
Okay.
So the Zulu force of 20,000 warriors attacked 1,300 British troops. The Zulus were equipped mainly with traditional iron spears and cowhide shields.
That's like defending yourself with a leather jacket. Yeah. Isn't it like a leather jacket stretched over a kite?
Essentially, yeah. But they're bloody good with them.
Well, yeah.
They were bloody good with them.
See, I'm imagining me defending myself with a leather jacket stretched over a kite. But actually, I'm the weak link in that situation, not the leather jacket.
Yeah. Well, it didn't seem to make a great deal of difference, because although the British Army were armed with all the kind of modern rifles, the Zulus obviously were so numerically superior and so well organised against this rather piss poorly led and directed British government that the Zulus came upon them and absolutely routed them. You know, you had a forward line, so obviously the British had a forward firing line. That lot, every single one of them killed.
Wow. This is just like Vietnam, isn't it? Better firepower, but the Viet Cong just had shitloads more people who were much, much better at fighting.
Mm.
And they could just throw bodies at it.
Yeah.
And they had something to fight for as well, because it's their homeland.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Whereas how much do these soldiers really give a fuck about South Africa? They don't give a toss, do they? They're just following orders. There's no
point
there,
isn't there, where you think, you know, what I said earlier, you know, jokingly, sort of my country right or wrong. Mm. You're 6,000 miles from home.
Yeah.
Standing there going, I don't even know, this landscape doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah.
Hang on.
And also, it's, I guess South Africa is like, well, it's diamond rich, I suppose. Is it oil rich?
No, diamond rich.
Diamond rich. Yeah. But that doesn't come across, does it? So you'd be looking at you'd just be looking at the countryside going, what is it we're getting out of this exactly? Doesn't seem to be much.
Yeah, and even if you were aware it was diamond rich, you're not really going to be the one who's going to get that.
Congratulations, lads. Won another battle. Here's 50 diamonds. Doesn't happen, does it? Just going to have to go back to Plucky London to deal with a ripper.
So it was an absolute rout. Even though the British had their modern rifles and artillery, the Zulus completely overwhelmed this army and killed virtually all the 1,300 troops. My understanding is of the 1,300 fighting men, I think only 55 made it out of the camp.
Jesus.
Made it out of the area of the battle. And then they thought, oh, I know what we'll do. We'll go somewhere safe. Go up the road to Rorke's Drift. That's what they did.
Did they genuinely?
Most did, yeah.
That's a bad day, isn't it?
Well, they only had to then fight another 12 hours.
Christ.
The Zulus themselves lost about 2,000 people.
Yeah.
So even though they won it, they actually numerically lost more people.
Yeah. So it's sort of one-on-one, I guess, right? One person killed another person, and they ran out.
Mm. So like I said, this battle was the greatest victory the Zulu kingdom would enjoy during the war. The British centre column completely wrecked, its camp annihilated, with all these enormous heavy casualties. And that's to say nothing of the fact that they lost all their supplies, all their ammunition, all their animals, all their transport, all went to the Zulus. So this left old Lord Chelmsford, who wasn't obviously at there, he was away trying to look for the main Zulu army who were there. He had to hastily retreat out of Zululand.
Fucked off.
Mm.
But I guess what happened is they regrouped, realised they were a proper fighting force and came back and slaughtered them, right?
Eventually, yes. In the months that followed till August, that's sort of kind of what happened. Well, that's one of the sad things, is the defeat itself just made British resolve go, right, we're going to deal with them harder.
Shall I do the aftermath?
Do the aftermath.
So this is the aftermath. So anyway, word of the disaster.
What's this, Phil? The aftermath?
This is the aftermath. Yeah. I love the aftermath bit. That's my favourite bit,
okay.
I think. Welcome to the aftermath. Word of the disaster didn't reach Britain until 20 days later, 11th of February.
Imagine that.
1879. News is so quick now, I'm actively trying to ignore it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to ignore news.
It's too fast, isn't it?
Too fast.
Wouldn't it be great if they just go, oh, yeah. 23 days ago, Jeremy Corbyn allegedly said something anti-Semitic, which we've just heard about.
You could process it at your own time, isn't it? Like, amazing, like in the 80s, you know, the news happened at 6 o'clock in my life. There was no other news.
Yeah.
Happened at 6 o'clock. And, you know,
you sat down, you got your news.
You got your news.
And then you had your evening.
Yeah, much, much better than getting it. Oh, how many people have been shot now? They're just pumped into your phone every second of the day. I'm just going to check my phone to find out the world's still a piece of shit. Yep, it is. Brilliant. Okay, carry on with my day. But that, no, not in the Victorian period, a better period in many ways. The Victorian public were dumbstruck. Oh, Jack the Ripper and now this. they were dumbstruck by the news that these spear-wielding savages had defeated a well-equipped British army. Like we still do in this country, they basically tried to find a scapegoat. We fucking love a scapegoat.
Oh, blame. Oh,
whose fault was it?
Blame culture.
Blame culture. Blame... Yeah. I tell you who I blame, millennials. Even though nothing, literally nothing is their fault, I blame them for everything.
Always blame them.
Absolutely.
You know where you are.
So who do you think was the scapegoat?
I reckon there's
Patsy.
A chance.
He was the Patsy.
I reckon they'd have probably gone, the press barons would have probably gone for Lord Chelmsford.
Old Lord Chelmsford, obvious candidate. But he had powerful supporters, don't they always? Mm. Not least Queen Victoria. If you're a close personal friend to Queen Victoria, nothing bad's going to happen to you, really, is it?
You're pretty sound, I reckon.
Pretty sound.
Yeah.
Chelmsford, yes, he was the one who was fucked for it. He was urgently burying all the evidence, God bless the British. He was burying all the evidence that could be used against him.
Which suggested that they were probably right with picking their scapegoat.
Well, yes. I mean, he did... To be honest, he made a big mistake.
Yes.
He split his force up.
Yeah.
He got taken in by one of the oldest tricks in the book. I'm no military historian, as you know, Phil. But
you're no Monty.
But I wouldn't have fallen. Would you have fallen for that? If I was that arrogant, you see.
It's
arrogance, isn't it?
It's arrogance.
That's exactly what he was expecting to find, yeah. Wasn't it? So he was basically shredding everything. He was tossing the office. He was closing the shutters, right? He was firing all the interns. Okay. He ensured that potential witnesses to his errors were unable to speak out. Are we saying that he killed them?
I don't think he killed them, but he silenced them.
He silenced them with money or... Okay. Even more significantly, he tried to push blame for the defeat onto another colonel, a man called Durnford, who died at the battle. What a shit!
That's low, isn't it?
What a shit! He claimed that Durnford had disobeyed orders to defend the camp. What a shit! The truth is that no orders were ever even given to him. Ah, mate. Chelmsford has another weapon as well to use against his critics, and this... that is Rorke's Drift, of course.
Yes.
And I suppose, yeah, his life was that Chelmsford was basically getting under fire. He looked around for something that could improve British morale. He found Rorke's Drift and pushed that forward as another narrative for the war, which is what not just the British but everybody does, change the narrative, you know, to make the British people sort of support the absolute clusterfuck that you're doing abroad.
I've sunk the ship, but look at this lifeboat.
Yeah, exactly. Fucking bullshit, man. But we did get Zulu out of it, which is a great film.
So, Every Cloud.
Every cloud. Every cloud. Yes. But anyway, you know, it all comes out in the end, doesn't it? That's the thing I look about the British, is that after a while, when the years have passed, the truth comes out and we make sure that everybody gets their just desserts for the mistakes that they made.
Mm.
And so do you want to know what happened to Lord Chelmsford later on in his life?
Yes.
When all of this came out. The Queen showered honours on him.
Oh, right, yeah.
Promoted him to a full general.
Of course.
Appointed him Lieutenant to the Tower of London.
Oh.
And he didn't die until 1905 at the age of 78, playing billiards in his club.
Oh.
So justice was done.
Justice.
Lord Chelmsford, right, imagine what a boring piece of shit that man was at the club.
I remember.
Don't gentlemen ever heard of a... Gentlemen, ever heard of a little thing called Rorke's Drift? Oh, fuck off. Fucking Rorke's Drift. So, that was the Battle of Isilawana. Phil, Lucas, what do you reckon? God's fault or our fault?
Ooh, it sounds very much like it was our fault. And by our fault, I think I mean the British.
Yeah.
For invading.
Yeah.
However, I've got to say, to this day, that is still being argued.
Really?
Yeah, because like most things in life, you know, we long for things to be black and white. They are normally a muddy grey.
Yep.
You know, like I said earlier, you know, the Zulus, they had their faults.
Yeah.
We had our faults.
Yeah.
Arguably, our faults were considerably more...
Yeah, the Zulus didn't like come over in a boat and invade Birmingham, did they?
No. The Zulus, they weren't saints.
No, but that's not a reason, is it?
No,
is it?
No, I'm just saying,
no.
They're not saints.
Yeah.
But I think this...
I bet they thought they were saints. I bet they thought they were all right. I bet the Zulus weren't looking around at other Zulus going, we need to really clean up our act here because we're not nice people. But they thought they were awesome. Anyway, I bet they had all the same sort of faults that the British had, apart from that need to sail across the sea and fuck up other people's countries. So I don't know.
You've got to admire our confidence.
I don't feel like it's half of six of one, half a dozen of the other here.
No.
Yes, I broke into his house and nicked all his stuff. But, you know, I didn't like his dog.
I think you're right. I think it was the British fault. But my country, right or wrong.
Okay. Yeah, I enjoyed that.
Yes.
That was the Battle of Isilawana, an interesting one.
Mm.
Fact heavy, so I hope you enjoyed that, everybody. Some of these are going to be fact heavy, but I like them fact heavy.
Yeah.
Because I feel like you learn something.
Facts over feelings.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for listening. What are we doing next time?
We're going to do P Super, the Great London Smog of 1952.
Brilliant. If people want to tweet us to the show, where do they tweet?
We are at CB Wallop.
Excellent. If you have any thoughts, good or bad, i.e. good, please contact the show and tell us if you like it. And please review the show on whatever places need to be reviewed, I guess. That helps in some way. And follow us on Facebook. You got anything to add, Phil? Nothing to add.
No. You've covered it all there really, really effectively.
Thanks, man. Yeah. Thank you. Well, I enjoyed that. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you next time on CB Wallop Podcast. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.